Committee, before you is an agenda. Are there any other items to be added to the agenda? Not, okay. Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Next, we have the minutes of the May 9th meeting. Any questions, additions? Entertain a motion?
Move to adoption.
One from Mr. Dyke. Any seconds?
Second.
Second from Mr. Downey. All in favor?
Aye.
We have two informational presentations before us. We'll take the operating budget first, and this will be a third quarter operating budget summary by Ms. Kissel.
And I'm going to have Mr. Green take you through the third quarter results, which are very favorable.
Thank you. So I was here before you in March. This show will be up here in a moment. We were about $5 million in a positive position. At this point, through the end of the third quarter, we're about $21 million positive. So a good performance in the third quarter, as Carol referenced. We're about $21 million below our revenue target. I'll get to that in a moment. And about $48 million of positive on the expenditures. So the net of those is about, excuse me, I think I said 21. We're about $26.7 million positive. Just wait for a second here.
It's coming.
It's coming. I think we all have it in our books. Do you have the revenue charts in your books? I'm on the second slide, the second slide. Page we have it. Thank you. Actually, on page 25 of 29. So what this is the revenue, and in the third quarter, if you look at the bottom part of that chart, that shows the cumulative revenue position at the end of each month. And so you can see that after reaching a rather rapid $20 million underperformance through the end of December, since that time, it's flattened out quite a bit, and we're now about $21 million behind our revenue target. So for the last quarter, we only underperformed revenue by about $1 million, which is quite an improvement over the first half of the year. Is everyone following along with me here? Okay. Okay. Thank you. Passenger revenues actually had their best quarter. They were slightly negative, about $250,000 for the quarter, about 0.1%. About 30% on our total revenues, about 30% of that $21 million underperformance for the year to date was related to Hurricane Sandy and the federal holiday on Christmas Eve. We'll go to the expense side now. Flip page here, page 26 now. I presented this chart to you last time. This is the, I've kind of broken these next two slides. I'll summarize our labor, our personnel costs on the first slide, and then I'll talk about our non-labor costs on the next slide. So we are managing our labor. You can see there that overtime costs comprise about 7% of our total personnel costs for the year to date, of about $60 million a year through the first three quarters of the year. Salary and wages comprise about 62%. We've spent about $503 million on salary and wages year to date. And then benefits comprise the last piece, which is about 31% of each of these bars. So in summary, on the labor piece, salary and wages were about $23 million positive through the end of the quarter, through the end of the third quarter. Benefits about $14 million positive through the end of the quarter, and those track quite closely with each other. And then overtime had about a $16 million overrun through the third quarter, creating about a $21.5 million positive variance on our labor or personnel costs through the end of the third quarter. Bus had a pretty significant underrun, about $8 million. And then the rest was kind of spread around the organization. We got quite a jump from the last time we were here before you. On the benefit side, we received a $5.7 million health care rebate. This is an assessment of our health care costs that made at the beginning of the year, and then we actually true it up at the end of the year, and so our actual costs that we incurred were slightly less. On the overtime, before I leave, it's interesting to note that after the first, we've talked about this before, but the July and August overtime rates were quite high, and since that time, both the deputy general managers here have chaired a committee where we address overtime, and we've instituted several initiatives to manage those costs and bring them down. Over the last 6 months, since that summer peak, our costs are actually $3 million lower than the same period for both the preceding years, so it's heading in a very positive direction. On the non-labor costs, similar to the overtime, similar to the labor discussion, we've had puts and takes in several of the categories. On the materials side, we are about $11 million over budget year to date on materials, parts and materials. And a lot of that has to do with the rail car maintenance and the readiness for the Silver Line. And just to put that in perspective, what's going on, in 2012, we had 770 rail cars in daily service. By 2013, we're up to 906. And by the time that we introduced the Silver Line service, we'll be requiring 954 rail cars for daily service. So there's an enormous effort going on in Rob's organization to get those rail cars ready. The services have offset that overrun. We're about $21 million positive on services. And services, the biggest piece of that is our access contract. And so access is about $10 million positive year to date. That continues to be a very positive story, our access department. And then we've got some also positive news on our maintenance contracts for Ellis and financial services. But finally, the last component of our non-labor pieces are utilities, propulsion, diesel, and CNG. And we're about $18 million positive, or about 18% year to date on those categories. Last year, just for point of reference, at the same time, we were about $29 million, or 24% positive. As you'll recall, as part of the 13 budget development, we right-sized our propulsion, and we got it down more based on consumption than the past methodologies that we use. So we're getting that propulsion number down to where it actually should be. Of that $18 million, it's about $6 million on the consumption side, about $6 million on the price side. And the price, we were very fortunate, I think I discussed this last time I was here, to have a very favorable diesel hedge. We hedged the FY13 diesel at about 270, and I think we've all seen those prices peak over the last 6 months, so that was very fortunate. And then, not fortunate, good work by Raj, our treasurer. And then we got a $4 million compressed natural gas credit Congress that enacted in the January bill. And then about, that covers it, the consumption, the CNG, and the lower than budgeted rates. So all in all, as Carol said, a pretty positive story. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Downs?
I think it's really important about, you don't have to do it this quarter.
Sure.
But at the end of the year, if we had a $5 million net benefit on health cost, to try and attribute that to various pieces, one of which probably is an outcome of lower injury rates as a result of a lot of safety improvements among employees. If we can start to show net fiscal benefit about that, some of it is about wellness, some of it's about maybe a younger workforce, but it's really important about looking at that outcome and assigning it to specific actions. I think there's probably a reasonably good story there about the benefit of a number of programs.
Will do.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Mr. Green. We'll move back to the third quarter capital program progress report. Mr. True.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to present the third quarter report for fiscal year 2013 capital budget. We're tracking well on some projects, but our large-scale facility builds have been progressing slower than we expected, and this has resulted in less annual investment than previously projected. Again, we'd like to thank the support given to us by jurisdictional partners and also the federal government. This is a critical time for Metro as we rebuild the system and move towards supporting the Momentum Plan and beyond to 2040. Our investments to date for the capital program program through the third quarter of the fiscal year were just on the upside of $530 million, which puts us at 54% of the investment goal of $975 million and $70 million above our investments as compared to last fiscal year. Our success continues to be in our ability to invest in a balanced approach to bus, rail, and metro access and the support functions such as information technology. Achieving steady state continues to be a priority, and I'm very pleased with the progress that we're making, particularly in regards to track production. Nearly 95% of our track production comes from our own force account, and we have turned the tide on backlog of deficient items, specifically ties and rail. But please remember, we will always be engaged in that effort. We will continue to install 15,000 to 18,000 ties every year just to maintain the railroad. But these numbers show that our efforts are paying off. Shutdowns continue to be helpful. Time and space. In order to work productively and efficiently, we need this time and space. We understand the disruption, but I can't stress how critical it is to extending our capital dollar investment, and I appreciate our passengers' understanding of the necessity to do the work and allow us not to defer these important maintenance items. Again, you'll find these common headers in your 2013 quarter three report materials, and for the purpose of this presentation, I've only included specific items which we consider to be of high importance to the health of the system and also to our passengers. We have a balanced approach to all components of our transit network and ensure that there's equitability within the capital program. The replacement and rehabilitation of buses and metro access vehicles remains on target for 2013, with delivery of all planned vehicles within the prescribed time frame and within budget. We did get better pricing for metro access and will not reach our forecasted investment as a result of that savings. At this point, I'm going to ask Phil Wallace to come forward. I think it'd be nice if he could explain some of the investments that we do for the bus and how we improve it for both our efficiency and also for our passengers.
Thank you, Mr. Truth, and good afternoon. Pleasure to be with you this afternoon. What I want to show you today is five initiatives that affect the bus fleet from a procurement standpoint, from a rehabilitation standpoint, from a field action standpoint. They touch on... I got a big enough mouth, I thought.
They impact the safety of our fleet, the overall reliability of our fleet, the environment, and the cost effectiveness of the way we manage the fleet. In the middle section here is the most robust thing we've got on the fleet right now that improves the overall efficiency of the power plant, the engine. If your engine's not working efficiently, the bus is not going anywhere. Historically, and the standard in the industry is an old hydraulic system that drives a fan that cools the engine, or the engine coolant. They're old, antiquated, high maintenance impact, and with hydraulics, high pressure hydraulics, there's a potential for fires. So we've moved away from the old hydraulic systems and cut in a new EMP cooling system, which is all electric. You can see it's all controlled by electric fans. And the great thing is, it's when you go electric and electronic, you can control it and program it. So it makes for major efficiencies. We've actually seen about a 3.8% improvement in fuel economy on our hybrid fleet, which goes back to the cost and consumption issue. Some of the other side benefits, other than elimination of potential for fires. Also a big issue with this is trying to keep the radiators clean on the fleet. This has a blowback feature. Every day when the bus comes in the service lane, you get a switch, the fans reverse, and it automatically cleans the fans out. So we're going to see some major benefits as far as, we're already seeing major benefits, 450 of our buses in the fleet, either through new bus procurements or for our rehabilitation program, have this EMP coolant system on it. Another initiative that from a safety and environmental impact, the interior lights of the buses. The average bus or the normal bus has fluorescent tubes. High maintenance. Before we went down this path, we were spending about $250,000 a year in fluorescent tubes, ballast, and sockets. Then comes along environmental impacts. You just can't throw a fluorescent tube in the dumpster any longer. You have to crush it and go through a controlled process to get rid of fluorescent tubes. Hence, we introduce the LED interior light. It too, when we go electronics, you have programmability. So that gives us the capability from a safety standpoint to program the front section of the bus at nighttime. The operator has a glare issue with the windshield. So when the doors are closed, the lights can actually dim slightly to make the operator have a better field of vision. So LED lights, major impact there as far as the what the customer's seeing, an environmental standpoint. And the great thing about it, this is warranted for the life of the bus. We're not buying any more fluorescent tubes or anything of that nature. If we have a failure, it's replaced at no cost to the authority. So LED interior lights. Headlights is another safety issue. And in the course of a year, normal headlights, we're replacing about 5,000 headlights a year. High maintenance issue. And you don't want to be out there in revenue service or in service period and have a headlight go out on you. You always want your operator to have a good clear line of sight. So another initiative is to go to LED headlights. I'd ask you to look away from the light for a sec, but I'm going to turn one of these on. That's the low beam. That's the high beam. So it's a major, major improvement in visibility. These two are warranted for the life of the bus. So once we put them on the bus, when we do have failures, if we have failures, again, it's a major cost-effective way of doing business for the authority. Batteries. Batteries, the normal transit bus, 40-footer, has four batteries, very similar to what you have in your automobile. Lead-acid batteries. They're dinosaurs in the industry. The lead-acids can't keep up with the demand of all the electronics and electrical systems we're hanging on the transit coaches. We've done a lot of evaluation on what was available in the industry. We've moved to a fleet campaign. We're down to the last 100 buses. So about 1,400 of our buses now have these AGM batteries. They're not lead-acid. It's a gel substance. The average life of these is about 6 years as opposed to 1 year on a lead-acid battery. It's a major environmental impact because you're not disposing of batteries as frequently as you would be with the lead-acid batteries. And then last but not least, another very critical environmental issue, by 2020, the refrigerant that's used in most heavy transit buses, R22, is being phased out. So we come up with a strategy. We've cut in several years ago on the new bus procurements to move to an R407C product. So we've cut that in, but we've also cut it into our midlife overhaul process. This is critical because as we get closer to 2020, the cost and availability of R22 is dramatically going to impact the operation. Right now, as we sit here today, the R22 is three times the cost per pound that it is for the 407C. So as we do the conversion, we're also capturing the spent R22, filtering it out so that we can reuse it to support our system and keep our costs down moving forward. So behind the scenes, a lot going on to try to improve the reliability, enhance the safety, not only on rehabs, but new buses moving forward. So this is just a quick snapshot of five initiatives going on. Any questions? We thank you. Appreciate the board's support.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Phil. Again, the WMATA force account track production crew continues to work at pace with the projected versus planned installation. And the procurement of new and more efficient equipment has significantly reduced the backlogs for the ties and running rail. Escalator and elevator rehabilitation did fall behind as a result of some required changes to a processor's controllers, our decision to close out the red line, and also because of the elevator contractor, the subcontractor went bankrupt and it required us to revisit the designs and materials for that specific contract. That wasn't included in a board memo to you all recently. The replacement contract work will begin accelerating in 2014 as the designs are approved and fabrication moves into production. And any deferred work will be made up in 2014. What I want to be clear about is any of these deferrals, any of these work that we didn't make up, does not impact the overall schedule for the elevator and escalator rehabilitation contracts. We are able to add more resources by contract in order to make up any deficiencies that we had this specific year. So the overall schedule will not change in that regards. Cinder Bed Bus Garage is out of litigation, and our notice to proceed is projected for July 1. This fast restart was enabled by John Thomas, our director of MCAP. And that was because reacting to the pending litigation, he was able to establish price indices with the contractor that could hold their bid in place with a reasonable, fair, and impartial adjustments for inflation. We look forward to getting this project started, as I'm sure Jack does as well. Unfortunately, the test track and commissioning facility is behind schedule due to delays to getting the CSX easement. This is specific to the test track itself. It runs adjacent to CSX. You know, we went through a significant effort to be able to get CSX easement to be able to do construction activities on that. We missed our initial construction start window for that as a result of that. However, the commissioning facility and the parking garage, which are part of this, remain on schedule. We're looking at schedule recovery with the test track. The 7Ks that come in, we will be able to test them with little impact, or actually no impact to service. In the period of time that it will take the test track to get built. So we have contingency plans working within the yard and on existing infrastructure while the test track is being built. Our initiatives for the NTSB recommendations continues to move at the projected pace, and the replacement of generation track circuits being the most critical. Our work is currently progressing on the Orange Line with planned single track and shutdown events which support this critical endeavor. I do want to mention that we are now in the planning stages of closing out the first phase of the Red Line contract. Some elements of the work in Red Line Phase 1 were descoped. Most of the descoping elements were a result of work which could not have been accomplished without severe disruption to passenger service. However, these were not safety-critical items in any stretch of the imagination. The major descoping items were the electrical work and the CCTV work. The electrical work descope was a track access issue. Much of the work entails installation of cable through the duct bank. The challenge is the duct bank is between the tracks, and it requires total shutdowns in order for us to access the duct bank. Because of competing endeavors such as neutral host, the NTSB recommended track circuit replacement and also expanded platform work, we would have been unable to complete these specific red line initiatives without severely impacting passengers, without requiring significantly more shutdowns. For the CCTV installation, the station access was problematic, but we have also established more efficient methods and contractor vehicles under our electronic safety and security project, where we have installed over 1,000 new high-resolution digital IP addressable cameras throughout our station. So we will be moving that contract into our IDIQ contract, our indefinite quantities contract, for the installation of the safety and security cameras. We still have work to do. Backlog still exists on our station platforms, fasteners, welds, third rail, and some major state of good repair items such as bridge piers and also our tunnel relining at Medical Center. Obviously, lighting, passenger display systems, and signage continue to be part of our station work as we move to create a better station experience for passengers. We have begun to create efficiencies in our accounting procurement process, particularly in regards to more upfront coordination between the program office and procurement. Permitting continues to be arduous, but we are reaching out to our jurisdictional agencies to determine what we need to do better to streamline the approval process and to be able to gauge in construction of our facilities. This work will establish a better railroad, a better bus network, and also a better metro access experience for our passengers. And again, we recognize the work we do can be disruptive. It's important to note that time and space are critical, and we do our best to manage that within our passengers' comfort level. By rebuilding a better system, we position ourselves to make investment into expansion to serve the region as a safe, reliable, efficient, and effective transportation choice that will certainly drive economic benefits and create more livable communities. Thank you, and at this time, if there's any need for clarifications or questions.
Thank you. Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, let's go back to page 10 of 29, the investments to date as of March 31st. You reported, as far as actual expenditures, 54% as of the end of March, which, of course, is three-quarters of the year. And that still shows that we're ahead of last year's procurement profile, which is very important. We have a big capital program to execute, as you know, in future years and this year. And I'm concerned about the staffing levels. Are you at your full staffing levels yet, where we know how much we can really do? I'm a little concerned that we maybe not at the right staffing levels to execute more money in the project or projects themselves.
I think we have staff adequately within the program offices, some of the support offices, particularly procurement, human resources. I do believe requires some more capacity. We have been through a significant hiring phase, not just on the capital side, but also on the operations support side, which includes Dulles on that end. And as we look through these issues, some of these skill sets are very, very difficult to obtain, contracting officers. But yes, we are on the program side. I believe we are close to capacity for what we need to do, and that's been a large focus of human resources and the group to be able to get to that. Our next focus will be identifying those requirements there in procurement to be able to do that.
And one of the reasons I asked this is later on you talk about the challenges, particularly on the closeout of the Red Line Phase 1, and you listed competing priorities. And to me, sometimes that means, you have only limited staff to work on certain types of work, and so you have to kind of set priorities, and that delays the other project. And that's why I was asking that question, and I wonder whether that's an issue.
The competing priorities is not an issue of competing staffing levels. The competing priority is an issue of the work that we do along the guideway mostly, where we have to compete for track time. For example, the track circuit work, which we take with the shutdowns and with single tracking efforts, because of the nature of the work, they cannot have significant numbers of track equipment on that specific section of track while they're doing tests, because they're testing the track circuit, the levels, installing them. So those are where the competing priorities lay mostly. It's within our ability to execute the work within the capacity of the system to be able to withstand that. So that's when I talk about competing priorities. So, the NTSB recommendations, the track circuit replacements, were significant priority for us. Prior to that, the guarded number eights, again, were a significant priority for us to be able to do that. So that's mostly where the priorities exist.
Yeah, I just want to add to that certainly the Red Line Phase 1 contract, I think, was in place before most of the priority capital initiatives that we've had to undertake with regard to safety, since came along. In addition to that, under Rob's leadership, there has been a much improved effort of scheduling track outages and coordination so that we get a lot more productivity out of it than we did two or three years ago. So we, as we've been doing concrete and rail work, steel work, we've also been improving the organizational structure to support it.
Last question. This weekend you're going to be doing some final work, I think, on the Tacoma, Fort Totten, and another station.
Uh-huh.
Are you going to invite Ms. Porter and myself out to Tacoma for a ribbon cutting for the completion of the work there?
If you want, you can have it. Glad to do it.
I'll let you know Monday.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Downs?
One of the things that has always struck me about that capital reporting process, not about individual line items, but trying to make more visible what is actually produced, what's bought, not just the expenditure levels and how successful we are in spending capital money. You had made a presentation to the board, and I've mentioned this to Rich before, of a new framework. It was a model, and it was, I think, track fasteners, and it was a pretty simple graph that showed a whole bunch of things all at once, what the deficit was, what the catch-up phase was, what a stable state was, and it showed it by year. And the board, I think, was incredibly appreciative and kind of even knocked over about how powerful a way of presenting the production on the capital side. And the promise was, we'll see a lot more of that. And I issue a challenge to both you and to Rich about a way of starting to better explain an annual capital outcome you know, not necessarily on a quarterly basis, but when we do the annual recap of the capital program at the end of the year, what we've done, where it fits on that long chart about necessary replacement and state of good repair, so that we have a better tool to explain to people what we're producing. And the other is a suggestion about when we do a end of the year capital review, we also include a review of everything that we have done for the last 2.5 or so years on the capital side, that is cumulative, that we're making huge investments, we're producing a lot of product. We need to show what the impact is cumulatively, and I think we're all after a better way of telling a story. This is about fiscal accountability. The other is about having a story that people can understand about what it is you produce every year.
Comment on that. What we've tried to do in this thing is we actually show the plan for this year and how much we've achieved against it. I take your point that at the end of the year we can show it in a longer continuum. That's fine. The other thing that we are looking at is now that we've been at this for 2 or 3 years is to try to relate this back to operational impacts. It still won't address the customer who's stuck on one train, but we can see an improvement in reliability of operation, reliability, you know, car availability, those types of things which translate into showing a definitive progress as a result of all these investments. But we've got a little bit of track record behind us. I think we can start doing that.
But it was a very powerful, I thought that what you did with track fasteners was a very powerful piece.
And I agree. Coming back and now having shown how we progress through the year and say, oh, how does that fit in there? That's, sure.
So and Nicole, it shows also how long it took
to get there.
To get to the stable state.
Yes.
Repair.
Yep.
Mr.
Thank you, and thank you for your report. I appreciate it. Thank you. Just one question. If memory serves me correctly, this is actually the second report where you've made a point that one of the contributing factors to our inability to get our projects done on time is jurisdictional permitting. From a Maryland perspective, and perhaps my other colleagues would like, I mean, there are very few places that board members should meddle. But from a Maryland perspective, I'd like to know specifically what projects are being delayed because permitting is an issue. Because I do believe that it's appropriate for us to talk with jurisdictional leadership about understanding what those challenges might be. My comments aren't, and questions aren't meant to be accusatory of jurisdictions or of our staff. But I do believe it's important for us to understand what those issues are, why they occur. Did we have unrealistic schedules? Did those jurisdictions not have sufficient staff? Where did the breakdown occur that would cause something that should be just as important to the jurisdiction and should get a green light wherever feasible to get held up? Yes. And if it's significant enough that you would make it a part of a quarter of a report to the board, it must be significant enough to have a major impact on our capacity to deliver. And so I want to know specifically where and what projects.
Thank you. I think probably what the best thing to do for me in that regard would be to provide a board memo, because what we'll be able to do is delineate specific issues that resulted in some of the delays to that end. And you know, it'll be able to, like I said, you know, really define what the specific issues were, you know, with capacity of you know, the permitting staff, the capacity, you know, our scheduling, our, you know, adoption of practices that may have been outside of what we had expected, different agencies that had to, within the jurisdictions, different permitting agencies and different planning agencies who had to get involved. So I think the best thing that I could do is to be able to provide that in a board memo to you. I'd be more than happy to do that. Also understand that I agree with you. I know I said it in the last report, and we have been talking to the JCC about it. We have established meetings with the various partners, specifically in Prince George's County. There's some changes in the staffing there, so we did want to wait until that stabilized so that we could talk to the right people, which it has. So our government relations people are beginning to reach out to them, and certainly we would appreciate that. But I think, like I said, it would be best if I could give it to you in a memo to be able to provide that.
Well, I do want to know specifically, because I have no doubt that the leadership of all of our jurisdictions shares the priority that these would have. So there's no doubt in my mind that that's the case. And they're paying for these improvements also through the capital funding agreements and other mechanisms. So they're in their goal of getting it done just as quickly, I'm sure, is shared by us. So to the extent that things may have gotten lost or bollocked up or may have gotten on other priorities, we need to surface those issues so that they can get the proper focus.
And Mr. Nichols, we appreciate that, and we certainly appreciate help and assist that you could give us in that regard from the board standpoint. And again, I think when you provide the memo with the critical information, the detailed information, that'll be very helpful, to see how we move forward on that. So I would appreciate that involvement.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Downey?
Yeah. I just want to second the thought from Mr. Downs about graphically presenting the path that we are on. The goal is a system that's in a state of good repair. A system that's in a state of good repair has a constant level of replacement, but it's a level of work that can be accommodated within running the system. I think if we can show that, we can say there is, to coin a phrase, light at the end of the tunnel, that there will be a point where less and less of the time of the system. The other thing I think, and I'm happy to hear you say, the resource of track time availability is something that really has to be measured and used wisely and judiciously. And I think we can talk later about, how to do that. I don't think this is an exact comparable, but I do know in some major highway projects that I worked on, the contractor has to buy the time in terms of lane availability, and one of the measures of an efficient contractor, an efficient program, is minimizing that availability. So if we could get some sense of how much of the system's capacity and how much of the goodwill of our customers is going to be eaten up, we can evaluate how are we best using that to achieve the purpose that I think we all share. But we need to get people focused on what they're getting for their time, their disruption, and their money. So I'd like to work with you on that.
And just to add to that, one of the things is that we do listen to what our customers are saying in regards to the shutdowns, where the shutdowns take place. How shutdowns of single tracking on other lines may be affected. So we have looked at that. The media relations group, the project planning group, and the Transit Police Department have all gotten together. We get together every week to discuss upcoming shutdowns and say, okay, what do we perceive the impacts to our customers? How can we best manage that? What message do we need to get to them to make their commute or their travel experience much easier and try to manage around that end as well?
I mean, as one customer, I can say I've had three experiences recently that were good experiences. I'm sure there are others that could say the same, but it only takes one disgruntled customer to make everyone think the system doesn't work, and then people will not use it. But I can say I got to the Kennedy Center, I got to the ball game, I got to the opera, all on an orange line that was shut down, and with a good ride and a good time.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Bellamy, then Ms. Hines.
Yes. Question that keep coming up, and you don't have to answer me now. You can send me in a text memo. The question was, is what is the impact if the shutdown was longer? One of the concerns that we keep getting is that the weekend shutdown is basically impacting the riders. And their question was, is it 10 days? Do they need 12 days to be able to make the track repairs? And that would be better because then I know that I have an alternative. And I said I would ask the question. They raised the issue because they read an article about CTA shutting down the red line for 5 months. And I said that's a whole different type system. But they, each time we go out now, we get asked that question is, you know, can we get this pain over quicker?
And I think the short answer to that is that, you know, we recognize the disruption. We don't go in and just do specific track access improvements. We're also doing, like I said, we're doing emergency traction power box improvements. We're doing cable improvements in there. So not everything runs very linearly within the track outage. So what we try to do is put as many elements of work into that. I mean, we can, in one track shutdown, we can have 500 people working and 20 pieces of equipment depending on the nature of the work. So we try to do that. So, I mean, I'd be reluctant to say, you know, we're only going to need 12 more shutdowns or 12 days of shutdowns on the red line. I think the other thing is we have looked very, very closely at long-term shutdowns where it would make sense. There's a significant difference between the CTA, the MBTA, and the TA than there is to us. Our lines are very, very connected. They're very, very dependent on each other. We have separate lines that are very dependent on each other. Now, if you're in New York, generally you can get off a subway, you can walk a block, and you get on another subway that goes about the same place. So there's a lot of parallel routing efforts that they can do when they shut down specific lines. We're not able to do that, again, because, you know, we have very, very independent lines that, you know, through the transfer points then are connected rather than parallel routing, which, you know, CTA and the MBTA have, in addition to, you know, the heavy rail operations that the MBTA has. So, you know, we look at these things very, very closely because, again, I mean, you know, Rodrigo would love to be able to shut down the red line from, you know, Shady Grove to downtown and just lay 1,000 people in there 24 hours a day and be able to get the work done. Obviously, we recognize, first of all, the economics behind that to the businesses, which are supported by the rail line. So, you know, as we look at this, again, we say, you know, what's our customer pain point? What's the economic conditions that we would incur on the people in that regards? You know, and how can we do this work, you know, most beneficially and still maintain those items? So it is the items that we have looked at very closely.
And also, I just want to add to that from a, you know, high-level view. During the work weekdays, the transportation system is highly congested. You know, talked about this morning. The highways are, our subways are, the buses are, they're caught in the highways. The weekends, it's a different story. There's more room available. We never deny any person the ability to use public transit. They may have to use it as a bus rather than a train. And they may take a little longer, but they will get there. But there are other alternatives available for other people. To shut down a system, which I've been like in Philadelphia, where they shut down a subway line, but it doesn't play quite the critical role that Washington Metro Rail does, it's a significant amount. I'm not saying that we will never have to do that, but when we do that, it is only because there's really no other alternative. Because to do that, hurts the businesses, hurts the people that commute to work every day, and puts them into the rest of the transportation system, which is not moving too well. And that's my view of it.
So let me follow on where Terry was going. Some of what I'm hearing in our community is that people are just, they're not using the train on the weekend. They've switched to their cars or they're taking cabs for the most part because the bus service isn't particularly great either. Just to get around in Arlington, it's hard now to come up from Pentagon City and come out to Clarendon or go to East Falls Church or whatever. So, and I really appreciate all the technical reasons why we're doing what we're doing. I think we need to do it. So I guess my request is, can we flip this in any manner to ask ourselves if there's something else we can do relative to the rider? So, for instance, we run the shuttle when we close down. Have we thought about running the shuttle to the end of the line, particularly when you're working in Virginia? So once I get off the train at Clarendon, it's possible for me to stay on that bus to get all the way where I need to go to the end of the line. Then I don't have to change again. I don't have to tap in again. It's just my ride is complete. And when we closed Clarendon recently, the buses came with a great deal of frequency, which was wonderful. People really appreciated that. But I wonder about late night. I wonder about whether there's some way at, for late night, if we did run buses for longer hops, whether we couldn't have a little bit better service. Because one of the things I'm really hearing from people is it's the wait time in between that is really the reason they're making other choices. If they knew they were waiting 10 minutes or 12 minutes, that's one thing. But when you're at 20 and 25, all of a sudden you're just in a different game.
Yeah, Mary, I think that's a good idea. We certainly, when we have shutdowns today, we run both local shuttles as well as express from the endpoints of the shutdown. But to look at carrying further, provide a one-seat ride, I think is worth looking at.
Ms. Hutchins?
I just to try and orient the discussion, I understand exactly what you're saying, but I will tell you what I've heard is not just delays, but if you are a rail rider, buses are not necessarily the first invitation. Mm-hmm. So getting that information out to people that my experiences have been that it has been a seamless connection and rarely the interruptions. But you must be comfortable believing that rail and bus can be an equal transportation mode and somewhere that communications or the way the service can be delivered to, can help people understand that. Because too often, when people read that there will be a disruption, they internalize that their experience is going to be less, much, much less than what it would be normally. So it's I think it's a combination of that because
Well, I would say to you, too, one of the issues in Arlington is that right now there isn't a good bus alternative if you're coming from the southern part of the county and you want to go west. And so to the extent we have disruption in those places, people don't believe anything exists that works very well.
I didn't mean it as an alternative. I really meant as the alternative that's offered in making the shuttle piece. And you're right. If you don't ride buses, you won't know that until you encounter this. But it might be a good way to encounter it, to recognize that there are better alternatives. That's what we look to the future of what the system is going to be about.
Thank you. Are there any other questions or comments? Are there any other items to be brought before this committee? If not, this meeting is adjourned.
Could I ask the, the audits, could I have your attention please for a moment? The Audits and Investigations Committee does have a brief meeting that, and rather than to defer that, I'm going to see if we can do that piece now, and then so those who may be interested from a public standpoint in being aware of that, I want to make sure that opportunity is there without dragging you through the board's next break. So we're going to get the staff report. Won't take but a moment, I don't believe. I don't want to presume the dialogue, but it shouldn't be but a brief item. Thank you. And members of the Audit Committee, if you would wait, and anyone else who would care to join us, you are more than welcome. Thank you.
Changes that I'm sitting by, don't work that right over there, that's a
We are. I'm waiting for the report to come up. Oh, I love you guys.
I was.
Yeah.
Because we know it's going to happen again. The badge is going to be a quick way. We're going to do a quick way. Virginia's been doing that for the last 2 years, replacing bridges. And so, you know, it's a lot of prep leading up to that replacement. When it works, when it works, and when it doesn't, you're out of luck. Okay.
He decided to do it because he didn't want to have to go upstairs and get back down. And I don't think Helen could do that, so she had to run upstairs and get her material.
Alvin?
I'm ready. Let's go. Are we ready?
I don't know. Are we?
Are we good? Here's Helen.
Thank you.
Yeah, I know.